Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story, or just a story at any time of the day. Today, I'm excited to read a passage from the Charles Davies book, Bread Men, How the Westons Built an International Empire. The car eased through the village of Roundwood, scarcely disturbing the Sunday morning calm. It followed a gentle S-curve, a right past the parish church, a left past shops, houses, and the local pub, and then up a small hill and past a stand of pine trees. About a quarter of a mile outside the village, the car pulled to a stop beside two white-painted stone gate posts surmounted by matching statues of recumbent sheep. Seven men got out, making no sound except for the soft clasping of the car door handles as they shut. Each wore a blue mechanic's overall and carried a handgun and an Irish Army-issue Gustav submachine gun. Pulling balaclavas over their heads, they moved to the gateposts. The elegant metal gates were invitingly open, and the men could see perhaps 200 yards down a straight avenue, heavily shaded by ancient beech trees. In the distance was a small patch of field with mist hanging over it. On each side of the drive was a chest-high stone fence. Beyond, to the left, they could make out gardens, and in the distance, what looked like a large pond. To the right were woods. As if they'd been rehearsing for weeks, two of the men vaulted over the fence and disappeared among the trees. The other five started to walk single file down the avenue, slowly, warily, their boots making barely a sound on the worn asphalt. The heavy overalls quickly became oppressive. It was early in the day, but the August heat was overpowering, and their weapons began to slip in their moist hands. The men came to a split in the avenue, where the pavement gave way to gravel. To the left, the road arched around in a circle through trees and manicured lawns. To the right, it led to a courtyard at the back of a small two-story stucco castle with a crenellated roofline. It looked easy. The entrance to the courtyard was framed by the main house on the left and by a small gray stucco cottage on the right. Behind them, completing the rectangle, were white stone buildings, stables with wrought iron gates leading to the pasture beyond. The only sign of life was the car parked in the yard, proof that the estate's owner was home. The only palpable defenses were two miniature antique cannon sitting like discarded toys on top of a small stone wall by the main house. They walked faster now, heading into the yard so that they could break in through a rear door. But as they approached the house, a voice from the stables caused them to freeze. They were ordered to drop their guns. After a moment of incredulity and the indecision, the five wheeled and fired blindly on the stable buildings. There was an instant reply as automatic weapons hissed and cracked from the windows. In seconds, more than 100 rounds had been fired, and four of the five in the yard were on the ground. They had taken bullets in the head, chest, and arms. The fifth, with no place to hide, threw down his gun. The two who had been covering from the woods broke and ran, one apparently wounded as well. As police operations go, it was a classic trap. Told by an informant that the IRA would try to kidnap the owner of Roundwood Park and his family and to ransom them for £1 million, an elite group of Irish anti-terrorist police, the Garda, were waiting at the estate on Sunday, August 7, 1983. Once the guns had stopped, not one of the police force was so much as wounded. In a country cursed by the terrorism spilling across its borders from Northern Ireland, this was a major victory, one that prompted the Royal Ulster Constabulary to send its heartiest congratulations. It was also the payoff for the intense anti-terrorist efforts of the Garda since the kidnapping of well-known supermarket entrepreneur Ben Dunn. Yet, even in a country where the awareness of potential violence is second nature, the idyllic estate seemed an improbable location for a gunfight. The 245-acre estate is a commercial farm where sheep are raised for export, mainly to France. It's meticulously run by a silver-haired local, Joe Sullivan, and his wife Greta. Nestled in the hills of County Wicklow, about 25 kilometers south of Dublin, and just inland from Ireland's east coast, its late 18th century house and well-treed grounds afford an almost unmatched tranquility. Residents of the area joke that from the heights to the west of the main house, you can see England on a clear day. That may be far-fetched, but you can see serene, rolling green hills and small forests stretching to the horizon. It was this peacefulness that had attracted one of Roundwood Park's previous owners, former President of Ireland, Sean O'Kelly. It also appealed to O'Kelly's most famous post-war guest, the former Supreme Commander of the Allied armies in Europe, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who stopped over on his way to yet another White House. The pastoral beauty of Roundwood Park had likewise drawn its current owner, Canadian food magnate Willard Galen Weston. Weston and his family weren't there that August weekend. They'd been warned off and were staying in England at Fort Belvedere, their storybook castle in Windsor Great Park that was once the weekend retreat of Edward VIII. In any event, Weston was playing polo that weekend at the Guards Polo Club in Windsor with the team he sponsored, the Maple Leafs, a squad of gifted amateurs and professionals whose most august member is the Prince of Wales. The IRA threat seemed far from his mind that day. He played with his typical aggression, showing the kind of fearlessness that makes his friends wonder and his wife Hillary worry. At one point in the match, he was thrown from his pony. Periodic dues an enthusiast of the game has to pay. But although shaken, he remounted and carried on. Asked after the match about the IRA raid, he downplayed its significance, saying that what the men wanted was to steal paintings and furnishings. Yet, he also observed mordantly that the IRA hadn't done its homework. Everyone knew I'd be in England playing polo this weekend. These matches are advertised well in advance. There was some bravado mixed in with Weston's apparent sang-froid. He would later complain that the incident and the subsequent two-week-long kidnapping of one of his executives in Dublin had put his life temporarily under wraps. Never one to court publicity, he became sufficiently security conscious that, even in Toronto, he took to driving a beat-up, late-model car to remain inconspicuous. The incident may also have stirred unpleasant memories. In the mid-1950s, when Galen was a teenager, his father had been publicly harassed by a disaffected and somewhat deranged employee who quoted from Hitler's Mein Kampf and threatened to seduce Galen's six sisters. An enduring legacy of that short burst of violence in August of 1983 was that Roundwood Park was no longer a quiet family sanctuary. Although Galen has made brief secret visits to check up on things, the rest of the family hasn't been back since. The raid exposed Weston's Achilles heel. Especially in Europe, where terrorism has become chillingly routine, the flip side of wealth and power is vulnerability. The fear of violence that used to be more or less the exclusive anxiety of politicians and diplomats now extends to business people, particularly business people who have celebrity status. That makes Galen Weston, with his impeccable credentials and remarkable ambitions, a prime target. The youngest of nine children, the 47-year-old Weston, is the principal heir to the food processing, retailing, and resources empire that was begun in 1882 by his grandfather, Toronto baker George Weston, and then built into a globe-girdling colossus by his father, the legendary acquisitor W. Garfield Weston. Through George Weston Limited of Toronto, Canada's fifth largest company in terms of sales, Galen directly controls the destiny of roughly 30 major North American companies with more than 57,000 employees that collectively generate more than $10 billion in revenues a year. And through the Associated British Foods, ABF, the conglomerate managed by his 59-year-old brother Gary, he also has a major say in the fate of another 48 companies in Europe and Australia, many of which have subsidiaries of their own, with annual revenues of roughly $7 billion. With the possible exception of natives living in remote areas, there likely isn't a living Canadian who hasn't dealt with a Weston-owned company or used a Weston-made product. Shoppers in the Maritimes buy their weekly groceries from stores stocked by Atlantic wholesalers, while their brethren in Central and Western Canada haunt the aisles of chains run by George Weston Limited's best-known subsidiary, Loblaw Companies. Loblaw's, Zehrs, Westfair Foods, and Kelly Douglas stores all come under its banner. In any and all of them, consumers can choose from a bewildering array of Western products. They can start their day with a shower using President's Choice soap and shampoo, just two of more than 400 products that have been developed by a rapidly growing subsidiary called Loblaw International Merchants, and then breakfast on Weston's basic white bread, still soft and chewy after all these years, or if they're health and diet conscious, on a toasted slice of fiber goodness. Just to make sure they're getting a good start, they can pop a no-name multivitamin and mineral pill along with their orange juice. For lunch, they can make sandwiches using cloverleaf tuna or salmon, with a few Amigo tortilla chips on the side, and finish off with a glass of milk and a few chocolate-covered caramel biscuits, one of dozens of different types that Weston's makes. To keep going through the afternoon, they can snack on Nielsen Jersey milk or Crispy Crunch chocolate bars. Then at tea time, they might nibble on some cheddar crispy wafers or stoned wheat thins, all washed down with a cup of Twinings tea, courtesy of a subsidiary of ABF. For dinner, there's always a steak from the Loblaw's meat department, or some Rupert Brandt fish fillets for the entree, followed by a cup of President's Blend coffee. Then, a quiet time in front of a blazing President's Choice fire log, a quick brush with no-name toothpaste, the application of some White Swan toilet tissue, and off to bed. Galen Weston isn't exceptional simply because he had the supreme good fortune to be born in the right place at the right time. As the youngest of nine children, two of whom were older brothers steeped in the family business as much, if not more, than he was, he could have easily drifted into self-indulgence and well-heeled insignificance. Nor is it simply that he's fabulously wealthy. Based solely on the common stock he holds in George Weston Limited, Galen Weston is worth slightly more than $1 billion. Even without his stake in the ABF Group in Britain, which at recent stock prices and excluding shares in family holding companies and trusts, amounts to $4.8 million worth of ABF shares held in his name, and miscellaneous real estate and commercial holdings, such as retailing company Holt Renfrew Limited, he'd be one of the five richest people in Canada, and probably one of the 100 richest people on the face of the earth. Yet, what's truly extraordinary about Weston is that he approaches his family business as if it were still embryonic, still in need of raw entrepreneurial guidance and development. More than 100 years and almost three generations after George Weston baked his first loaf, the head of the family empire has an undiminished predisposition to risk-taking. It's easy to gloss over this fundamental truth, partly because Weston leads an existence that makes lives of the rich and famous appear small-scale and banal. The occasional checker with Prince Charles is simply the cap on a life that from the beginning has been played out in surroundings of elegant houses, fine cars, and international chic. Galen and his wife, the former Irish fashion model Hilary Frayne, regularly turn up on best-dressed lists and at the most exclusive social functions. They are two of the rocks upon which social columnist Zena Cherry stands. They are associated with a list of worthy causes and institutions, ranging from Toronto's Mabon School to Ireland Fund of Canada, not to mention taking an active role in the affairs of the W. Garfield Weston Charitable Foundation, set up by his father primarily to channel funds into medical research. At Weston's level of classic, quiet wealth, as one friend of the family puts it, there really are no sectarian or social boundaries. Although Galen's background is Baptist and Methodist, he has been a sponsor of the annual charity dinner put on by the Catholic Archbishop of Toronto, Emmett Cardinal Carter. He's also known for discreet acts of kindness, such as the time he spent hours counseling and arguing with the son of Roundwood Park's manager, trying to convince the boy to attend agricultural college. People who've met Weston tend to recall the circumstances perfectly, often with dramatic flourishes of the kind that used to be reserved for anecdotes about royal visits. Gillen Weston doesn't just schlep out of his Toronto office at the end of the day, as one consultant recalls. He sweeps out of a private elevator, glides across the lobby in a floor-length sable coat, accompanied by two attack-trained Doberman pinschers. His idea of a knockabout weekend jalopy is a Mercedes convertible. Gillen Weston doesn't yawn and stare over your shoulder when he talks with you. He speaks in a soft, ever so slightly nasal, mid-Atlantic voice, and listens intently to what you have to say, as if your opinion on the state of shopping carts were the most important thing since Einstein elucidated the theory of relativity. Weston's memorable public image is helped by his being an inch over 6 feet, athletically trimmed and costumed with casual perfection and the finest that Savile Row has to offer. In soft light, he looks as if he could be Paul McCartney's older, more refined brother. At 47, his once chubby, boyish face has become leaner, the cheekbones and the bridge of his nose more pronounced. The dazzling blonde hair he had as a small child is now largely gray, but it rolls back in aristocratic waves from a clear, perfectly tanned brow. As the years have passed, in fact, he's developed an eerie resemblance to his father, the late Garfield Weston. The style, the bearing, the intrinsic self-confidence, the good humor, the almost congenital good manners, and of course the money, have put Weston on an international social rung somewhere between the Kennedys and the Windsors. Most of the waking hours of his youth were devoted to being groomed to be what he is today, a genteel but capable entrepreneur who has assumed the mercantile equivalent of an imperial throne. His father, Garfield Weston, was like a medieval ruler, periodically moving his court from one part of his kingdom to another, always in search of more companies to buy. After 1933, the elder Weston lived mostly in London, England, but at various times he also lived in Toronto, Vancouver, and the United States. In his annual filings with the federal and provincial governments for George Weston Limited, Garfield rarely gave the same address 2 years in a row. He was a staunch family man who believed in having his wife and children by his side. Gillen, who was born in 1940 in wartime Britain, simply became the tail end of the family retinue. Before he enrolled at the University of Western Ontario in the late 1950s, he'd attended no fewer than 17 schools, most of which were public since his parents felt private schools like the British Old Boy Network they served were becoming a thing of the past. He'd also acquired a more high-level corporate experience than most executives gain by the age of 50. Garfield Weston believed in educating his sons, but not his daughters, in the family business with a combination of humble and responsible duties. Gillen followed in the footsteps of Granger, the eldest who'd been dispatched to Texas to run Weston interests there, and Gary, who was proving himself in his father's Australian companies, by getting his basic training fairly early. At 16, the baby of the family spent his summer in the advertising department at Loblaws Limited in Toronto. The next year, he was toiling at Deutscher Supermarket Handels, a chain his father had invested in West Germany. That same year, he and Gary, who was then 40, were put on the boards of George Weston Limited and ABF to see how things worked. You were listening to The Big Snore. That was a passage from Charles Davies' book, Breadmen, How the Westons Built an International Empire. Thank you for listening. Until next time.